Penguin Random House Audio presents Hope, a novel by Andrew Ridker. Read for you by Rob Shapiro. Forever Aaron Sellers. The Hunger Banquet, August 2013. Everyone will take a card, said Deborah Greenspan, cradling a wicker basket in her arms. The cards are divided into three tiers of income. Your tier will determine where you sit, with whom, and most importantly, how much food you'll eat tonight. She was small and stringy, all sinew and knob, standing with her shoulders squared and spine erect before a wall papered with William Morris pomegranates. I should add that the cards come with names and nationalities. We'll spend the night in character, almost like a game. It's educational, of course, but let's not forget that it's also supposed to be fun. Excuse me, Carla Cantor said. I thought this was a potluck. Carla sat beside her husband, Sydney, on a silver damask sofa Deb had recently purchased to replace the love seat that for years had occupied its place. In addition to the Cantors that evening, there were three other couples, the Selzers, Saxes, and Steins, clustered like a class of school children eagerly awaiting instructions from their teacher. Deb's mother-in-law, Marjorie, sat in one of two mahogany bergères, also new, her head bobbing as she slipped in and out of consciousness. Not quite, Carla, but I appreciate the bob cut. No, the purpose of this evening is to replicate, in a controlled environment, the lottery of birth and its consequences. Carla blinked. The lottery of birth and its consequences. It's important that you pick your card at random, no peeking, to make sure that we emphasize the element of chance. I'm sorry, said Carla. I'm not sure I understand. Deb flashed a diplomatic smile. Then I guess you'll just have to wait and see. The Greenspans lived in an eccentric Queen Anne at the northern end of Crowninshield Road, where the quaint suburban quiet of Brookline, Massachusetts, gives way to the tremble and clamor of Commonwealth Avenue. It was here that Deb dreamed up her neighborhood initiatives, here that she held house parties for Democratic hopefuls, here that she hosted Passover Seders where she served her celebrated brisket, the secret, a dusting of Lipton powdered onion soup, and homemade gefilte fish on plates her grandparents had smuggled out of Poland. With its canary-yellow siding, white window trim, and red pagoda roof above the door, the house, like its inhabitants, stood out among its gray, stucco neighbors. Unlike the other couples in her social circle, Deb hadn't moved to Brookline for the schools. She was born in this Sylvan streetcar suburb and more than anyone embodied the spirit of civic engagement that made it such a special place to live. When she wasn't raising money for the high school's innovation fund, she chaired her synagogue's resettlement committee, procuring housing and furniture and steady work for immigrants. She baked flourless cookies for the crossing guard with celiac and invited Holocaust survivors to speak to local students. She remained a reliable chaperone for field trips long after her own kids had left for college, guiding sixth graders through the dead mills of Lowell, passing out condoms and bottles of water at the LGBT youth dance held each year at City Hall. Where Deb found the time to perform these good works while bringing up two apparently well-adjusted children was a mystery. She had raised them on salmon and positive discipline, T. Barry Brazelton and after-school enrichment, prearranged playdates and Bill Nye the Science Guy, birthdays at the Boston Children's Museum and plaster fun time. She had read them Maurice Sendak to fall asleep and played Caribbean folk tales on cassette. She'd bought Legos and Kinects and Mavis Beacon teaches typing, tickets to the MFA and puppet show place theater. She'd signed them up for swimming lessons at the JCC and classes at the Russian math school in the afternoons. There were some, like Carla Cantor, who believed that Deb had invested too much time in her children, that there was something almost pathological about her level of involvement. But if Deb's critics disapproved of her methods, they couldn't argue with the results. Her daughter, Maya, worked at an august New York publishing house whose colophon, a fruit tree representing knowledge, was stamped on the spines of all the best books in the house. Her son, Gideon, was pre-med at Columbia, preparing to follow in the footsteps of her husband, Scott. "I love what you've done in here," said Gail Sachs, stroking the arm of the silver sofa. Gail, whose expansiveness was covered by a flowing floral caftan, owned a woman's clothing boutique on Harvard Street and knew something about fabric and color. "After dinner," Deb said, "I'll give you the grand tour." Her financial planner, Marty Selzer, feigned offense. "Redecorating can be costly," he said. "I can't believe you didn't consult with me first." "She hardly consulted with me," Scott said. He sat in the second bergère and seemed to be resisting the urge to rest his feet on the beveled surface of the coffee table, at the center of which sat a hardcover copy of Frederick Law Olmsted, Designing the American Landscape. "I feel like a stranger in my own living room." Scott ran a private cardiology practice in the heart of the Longwood Medical Area, a concentration of hospitals and medical schools that accounted for roughly $1 billion of NIH funding each year. Despite his professional success, he made himself available to friends and family, dispensing free medical advice to anyone who asked. Standing 5'10" in his New Balance sneakers, Scott was, by far, the tallest of the Greenspans. With a forehead so vast, it seemed to refer to the size of the brain tucked behind it. Owing to an infection he'd contracted as a child, his left eye was locked in a squint, fixing his face with a look of permanent irony. He always seemed to be staring at his life from afar and finding it almost too good to be believed. "I didn't know I needed permission," Deb said, watching the basket make its way around the room. "I didn't know I had to clear it with the man of the house." "Hey now," Scott said. "Perlman is the man of the house, not me." "Where is he, anyway?"
"I've got him," said Buddy Stein, stroking the striped tabby on his lap.
Buddy, who had served as the city's transportation commissioner before retiring to consult on the seaport development, occupied the wide cushion next to Carla Cantor. His petite wife, Judy, perched on the armrest.
"Grab a card for me, will you, honey? Little guy's purring like an engine over here."
"Get this," Scott said, his thin lips canted in a crabwise smile. "My lovely wife gave our cat an IQ test."
"You're kidding."
Deb beamed. "Perlman is a genius." "Allegedly," Scott said, "but I've got scars that suggest otherwise." Sidney Cantor, scrolling through the news on his phone, dipped his free hand into the basket.
"Nelson Mandela was just discharged from the hospital."
"Put that away," Carla whispered.
The word hospital roused Scott's mother from her sleep.
"Oh," she said suddenly, "my shoulder."
"Is everything all right, Marjorie?" asked Judy Stein.
"It's my shoulder. It hurts. I can't drive back tomorrow. Not like this."
Though she lived most of the year in Washington, D.C., Marjorie spent her summers on Cape Cod and dropped in on her son whenever possible. A stately woman with a hive of cotton candy hair, she was a regular presence at Greenspan family functions and could be counted on to liven up a party with incredible, Scott would say fictitious, stories. He sighed.
"I'm driving you, Mom. All you have to do is sit still. You can sleep for all I care.
Matter of fact, that might make the trip easier.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?